In theaters across the nation, the last part of the Lord of the Rings movie saga is playing to packed houses.
I see in your eyes the same fear that would take the heart of me. A day may come when the courage of men fails, when we forsake our friends and break all bonds of fellowship. But it is not this day. This day, we fight!
The stirring epic is a story of responsibility thrust upon the unprepared, hope in the face of overwhelming odds, the threat and seduction of power set in a fantastic world of magic and wonder and heroes. Its creator is a mysterious and fascinating and unlikely figure. J.R.R. Tolkien was a distinguished professor of English at Oxford University, a rumpled, tweedy pipe smoker who devoted much of his life to the invention of languages that no one ever spoke and mapped a world that existed only in his imagination. His influences included ancient Norse and German legends, old English tales of the hero Beowulf, and the very modern trauma of the trenches on the Western Front in the First World War. Later in the program, we'll look at some products of the Iraq War hitting toy store shelves near you just in time for Christmas. But for most of this hour, we want to talk about John Ronald Reuel Tolkien, the author of The Lord of the Rings. Yes, we'll talk about the movies, but our focus is the events and scholarship that shaped their creator and his lasting influence on the genre of fantasy that he helped create. Later in the program, Ursula Le Guin will join us to talk about that. If you have questions about Tolkien's life and how it shaped The Lord of the Rings, join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now from the studios of WHYY in Philadelphia is Daniel Grotta, the author of J.R.R. Tolkien, Architect of Middle-earth. Nice of you to be with us today.
Very good to be here.
Let's start at the beginning. Tolkien was born in South Africa to English parents. His early years were tumultuous.
Well, actually, several of the events that happened to him in The Lord of the Rings, were incorporated into The Lord of the Rings. Notably, he was bitten by a tarantula when he was about 2 years old, and this was translated, of course, into the incident with Shebob when Frodo was bitten and encapsulated in a spun cocoon.
Don't give it away. Some people haven't seen the movie yet.
Okay.
Well, all right, we'll give it away. The good guys win at the end. Go ahead.
Well, his father died when he was 4 years old, and he was uprooted from South Africa rather abruptly and carted back to England, where he was raised by his mother until she died of complications from diabetes. And then both he and his younger brother, Hilary, became orphans under the care of Catholic priest. And this, of course, shaped very much his whole outlook and perspective on life. But in South Africa, he had very fond memories of the warm climate, of the kraal, of the people there. And in a way, this became part of Middle Earth as well as the village in which he was raised before his mother died. It was a little village called Sarahall, and it was on the edge of Birmingham. It later became incorporated as part of the city. It was swallowed up, and he loved that with such a passion that this became the model for the Shire.
And in his lifetime, though, that English countryside that you're talking about, it certainly changed quite dramatically.
Absolutely. After World War I, Sarahall disappeared entirely. The old mill that he played with simply disappeared. Also, when he was at Oxford as an undergraduate, this was a fairly pastoral place with the colleges and the open squares. But a man by the name of William Morris invented a motor car there that the factory became actually on the outskirts of Oxford, and then it became an industrial city. And this distressed him as well, that the world that he had grown up in was being overturned by the 20th century, and the events of the 20th century were things that he disdained. He never came to terms with the 20th century, actually. And in a way, this was part of what happened with The Lord of the Rings. He created a world that was more to his liking, where there were hard choices to be made, selections or choices between good or evil, but they could be made. There were very few shades of gray.
Let's get some listeners involved. Our telephone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and if you'd like to send us email, TOTN at NPR.org. And Chris joins us on the line from Phoenix, Arizona.
Hi, guys. My question was just about what you guys were kind of just commenting on. And I had read for a while, actually went to a class at NAU here in Flagstaff, about how Tolkien had worked in his feelings even on the Second World War, and about the encroachment of the Nazis and how they were represented in the books by different characters such as the Nazguls. And just any other comments that he knew about that, I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for the call, Chris. Okay. Is The Lord of the Rings an analogy to the Second World War?
Not really. Tolkien very strongly and adamantly denied that the orcs were Nazis, although he later admitted, well, yes, there were things that they had in common. In fact, the word orc comes from the word death. And the death's head of the SS, of course, was a very prominent symbol during World War II. But more of The Lord of the Rings was taken from his experience in World War I as a lieutenant. He was a signals officer in the Lancashire Fusiliers, which served in the Battle of the Somme. The Battle of the Somme in 1916 was probably the single most destructive battle in world history. Over a course of about 4 months that the battle played out, almost 1,200,000 casualties suffered from both the German and the Allied side.
Famously, 20,000 British soldiers died in the first 15 minutes of the Somme, but as you mentioned, the battle continued for another 4 months. Thousands of corpses in the course of the battle were abandoned in no man's land where neither side could get to them. And we have a clip of tape here of survivor George Worsley describing the nightmare plague of rats and bluebottle flies that feasted on the dead. I want to warn you, the next 30 seconds of tape include some very graphic images.
The rats were bloated, well, there were all those corpses to eat, and we were crawling with lice. And the bluebottles, there were countless millions of bluebottles. I couldn't exaggerate the number of bluebottles. They'd laid their eggs in them, and they came out like froth. The maggots, when they'd grown, were dreadful.
That tape, courtesy of the BBC. Second Lieutenant J.R.R. Tolkien served 4 months on the Somme, and what he saw and experienced permeates his books. And here is a scene that we've excerpted from the movie where the rambling Gollum leads the hobbits Frodo and Sam through a vast swamp covering an ancient battlefield where the faces of the dead are still visible below the surface of the water. Daniel Grotta, this experience in this charnel house, so as you say, one of the worst battles in human history, how do you think it shaped Tolkien?
Well, I'm going to read two things. One is a poem by the very well-known English poet Wilfred Owen, who was killed on the Western Front only 1 week before the armistice in 1918. And then I'm going to read a passage from Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings. In fact, it was the same excerpt that the movie that you just quoted had. Mm-hmm. But first, let me read just a little bit of the poem, Dulce est decorum est. Bent double like old beggars under sacks, knock-kneed, coughing like hags, we cursed the sludge till on haunting flares we turned our backs, and towards our distant rest began to trudge. Men marched to sleep. Many had lost their boots, but limped on, bloodshod. All went blame, all blind, drunk with fatigue, dead even to the hoots of tired, outstripped 59s that dropped behind. 59s being artillery shells.
Yeah.
Now, in Tolkien, let's go to The Lord of the Rings again, The Marsh of the Dead. And here's what he had to say. And you can see how this comes very close to the description that Wilfred Owen had in the front, in the trenches. Dreadful as the dead marshes have been, and the arid moors of the no man's land, more loathsome far was the country that the crawling day now slowly unveiled to his shrinking eyes. Even to the mirror of dead faces some haggard phantom of green spring would come. But here neither spring nor summer would ever come again. Here nothing lived, not even the leprous growths that fed on rottenness. The gasping pools were choked with ash and crawling mud, sickly white and gray, as if the mountains had vomited the filth of the rentals upon the lands about. High mounds of crushed and powdered rock, great cones of earth fire-blasted and poison-stained, stood like an obscene graveyard in endless rows, slowly revealed to the reluctant light.
Hmm. Yeah, obviously, that's Wilfred Owen, and the other famous World War I poets, Rupert Brooke, among others. Yet their whole take on the First World War, and I'm not sure Tolkien would disagree, a pointless, bloody, that battle in particular, utterly futile, but Tolkien came away with a very different reaction to warfare than they did.
Well, he did not glorify war. Quite to the contrary, he loathed war. But it still had a fascination for him, because when you look at The Lord of the Rings, most of it is talking about destruction and death and battle. But again, we're talking about the conflict and the contrast of good versus evil. Mm-hmm. And going back to his World War I experiences, he was a reluctant soldier. He did not join the first day when war was declared. In fact, he didn't join up until after he graduated in 1915, at which time most of his friends had already gone and most of them had already died. And he didn't join a local regiment, but he joined the Lancashire Fusiliers because one of his close friends had also joined that regiment.
Yet he also sees the warfare, certainly in The Lord of the Rings, as a vehicle where heroes make a difference, and certainly nothing that like that happened in the trenches in the First World War.
Well, no. The only thing is he had a great deal of respect for the men under his command. He was a second lieutenant, and then eventually he left the army in 1920 as a first lieutenant. But in his platoon, which was a signal platoon rather than a combat infantry platoon, he greatly admired the sergeants and the corporals. These were common men, working class, farmers, who had come, and they didn't want to be there either. They weren't heroes, but they did heroic things, heroic deeds. Mm. And this was the thrust of The Lord of the Rings, of ordinary people thrust into extraordinary circumstances and raising to heroic heights.
Interesting to think of another signals officer who also served on the Somme, A.A. Milne, and wonder how the battlefields of the First World War shaped the geography of the Hundred Acre Woods. Perhaps not at all. We're talking about J.R.R. Tolkien, the author of The Lord of the Rings and the influences that shaped the books, both in his scholarship and his life. If you have questions or anecdotes about Tolkien, give us a phone call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or you can send us email. The address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. We'll be back after a short break. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the author of The Lord of the Rings and the historical and literary influences on the trilogy. You're invited to join the discussion. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or email us at totn@npr.org. With us from the studios of WHYY in Philadelphia is Daniel Grotta, the author of the biography J.R.R. Tolkien, Architect of Middle-Earth. And joining us now to talk about Tolkien's scholarly inspiration is Michael Drought, a professor of English at Wheaton College in Norton, Massachusetts, and a leading Tolkien scholar. He's with us at WBUR in Boston, and thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Tolkien fans know that Tolkien was a linguist, that he actually wrote the books to showcase the languages which he'd invented, at least to some degree. But tell us how that actually plays out in the story.
Well, what Tolkien, he had been from a very early time, since he was in World War I, he wrote his first notebook in a camp before going into battle. He would be making up these elvish languages, and he had then started to realize that he needed a history and a geography to go with the elvish languages to explain them, and that were the roots. Those were the roots of the Lord of the Rings stories, or the Silmarillion stories that came before them. So in some ways, when he says the whole point of the stories was just to give a background to the languages, he wasn't lying about that.
Hmm. Now, what are the chief cultures that he drew upon for his languages and the books?
Well, his two major languages are called Quenya and Sindarin. Quenya is considered like Elvish Latin, and it's based on the phonology of Finnish. He never really learned to read Finnish particularly well, he said, but he was captured by the way the language sounded. And so Quenya sounds something like, Ai lorie lantar lasi surinin, jeniontuime ve ramaraldaran. You can kind of hear the vowel harmony that Finnish would have.
And we certainly hope you're not saying anything that we would ordinarily need to cut off the radio.
Absolutely. And then the other language is Sindarin, which is based on the phonology, and more loosely than Quenya is on Finnish, but on Welsh. So you have A Elbrith Gilthoniel, Slivrin Penemiriel, Omenal Aglar Eleneth Nacared Palindiriel. And that has, again, a different feel to it. And so he wanted to explain where those languages came from, why different elves were speaking them, and so on. And he made up the stories to go behind them.
Hmm. Now, when you read these books as a scholar, I mean, you're getting jokes that the rest of us aren't?
There are actually quite a number of little scholarly asides and jokes in there. One of the biggest ones comes in all the material in Rohan about the horse people. The Rohirrim speak Anglo-Saxon, but they don't just speak regular old West Saxon, which is what everyone learns if they take an Anglo-Saxon course. They speak Old Mercian, which is a particular dialect, which happened to be the part of England that Tolkien's ancestors came from. And within that kind of little private joke, there's a bigger joke in that there's these names of kings. There's Theoden and Theodred and Eomer and Thengel, and every one of those is an Anglo-Saxon word for king. So you can almost, what's your king's name? His name is King. What did you expect? And those are the kind of little inside jokes that I think he enjoyed putting in there.
Let's get another caller on the line. Andrew's with us from Lakewood, Ohio.
Hi. Hi, Neil. Thanks for having me on.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, as I was listening to them speak just now, they answered one of my questions. My other question is, as I was reading The Hobbit this year, I noticed that when Gollum is introduced, he pretty much says in the Hobbit that you know, nobody knew where he came from, and then, you know, that's sort of like he was and that's it. And then all of a sudden in Lord of the Rings we have Gollum coming back as this immensely rich character and probably one of the most enjoyable characters throughout the entire series. And I was curious as to you know, if Professor Tolkien ever commented on that shift of thinking, or you know, what inspired him to leave Gollum within the story and kind of help him come to a completion within the arc of the storyline.
An enjoyable but also disturbing character.
Yes, I
don't know which one of you would care to take a shot at that.
Well, Gollum in the Ring gave Tolkien enormous problems, because in the first edition of The Hobbit, Gollum gave the ring voluntarily to Bilbo and led him out of the mountain. And Tolkien could not figure out how to get that to work with his later conceptions of the ring as evil and hard. And so what he did, when he came up with the 1951, there was an opportunity to do a revised edition of The Hobbit, and he rewrote the entire chapter. And that's why, it always confused me as a kid when I was reading this, that's why when in Chapter 2 and later on, when Bilbo, or at the Council of Elrond, when Bilbo says, now if any of you have heard this story in a different way before, I apologize, that never made any sense to me. But what Tolkien was doing was talking back to the people who'd read the earlier version of the book.
Daniel Grotta, I guess if you're making up history, you can go back and revise it too.
Well, yes. Actually, The Lord of the Rings was not an outgrowth of The Hobbit so much as it was supposed to be a sequel. When The Hobbit was published in 1938, his publishers asked him for another book using the same characters. So Tolkien looked around and he said, what sort of continuity can I have to bridge to the next book? And that's where he took the ring and he said, well, let's make this a ring of power. And he started weaving in earlier mythology that he had written and put into a book that he called The Silmarillion, which he had submitted earlier. It was rejected as being unpublishable. Perhaps many would consider it still to be unpublishable.
It's been published.
Yes, it is, but it's virtually unreadable to the average person. It doesn't have the richness, the continuity, the ease of flow that The Lord of the Rings has. It's much more of a scholarly take.
Andrew, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Here's an email we got from Robert McCatherine in Salt Lake City. John Ronald Reuel Tolkien, being a literary scholar at Oxford, is rumored to have been annoyed by sports and perhaps felt the athletes were just as bad. Did John ever fess up to having made up the acronym ORC in reference to the Oxford Rugby Club? Daniel Grotta?
Well, first of all, Tolkien played rugby when he was at Oxford. In fact, part of the speech impediment that he had, he attributed to an injury that he had to his mouth when he was playing rugby. There were feats at Oxford, and there were also ruggers, what we would call athletes. And he was sort of in the middle. He played a number of sports, and yet he was considered to be very intellectual. And he didn't like having to make a choice. And as an adult and later in his retired years, he very much enjoyed watching tennis on television. So he did like sports, and yet he didn't like the emphasis that was placed on them.
Before we let you go, Michael Drought, I did want to ask you about the influences of Beowulf in The Lord of the Rings.
Well, Tolkien was one of the three or four greatest Beowulf scholars of the 20th century, and Beowulf is a thoroughgoing influence. I mean, people see the obvious things in The Hobbit, where there's the dragon horde and the cup that's stolen and some of the words, and obviously in the Rohirrim speaking Anglo-Saxon. But there's a bigger connection with Beowulf, and that's what Tolkien thought the theme of Beowulf was. He said the theme of Beowulf was man, each man and all their works shall die, and yet you can't surrender and you can't give up because of that. And in the Council of Elrond, Galadriel talks about, not at the Council of Elrond, but in Lorien, talks about fighting the long defeat. And that's how Tolkien kind of saw, he didn't see civilization as a series of continual progresses, but it says it's a series of failures and defeats that nevertheless, and this is what he got from Beowulf, people weren't supposed to ever give up or give in to that defeatist notion.
I did also want to point out, we just got an email I wanted to read. This from John Gelluardi, if I'm not mispronouncing that, in San Francisco. What is it that makes J.R.R. Tolkien's language so powerful? His word choice has such an earthy resonance. You've studied that, certainly, Mr. Drought.
Yes, well, there's a couple things. First of all, he uses a very distinct vocabulary that comes out of Middle and Old English. Just to give you a couple examples, he uses the word pale to describe swords and describe gems. That's not a normal use of pale. It goes right back to the poem Pearl, and I think that it's kind of unconscious in there, that it seems more earthy. He avoids a lot of Latin words. He avoids a lot of French imports to the language, and he uses Anglo-Saxon, the modern reflexes of Anglo-Saxon, a lot more, and I think that makes it give it a distinct feel that seems, you know, closer to the earth and closer to the countryside. I mean, and he was deliberately doing that. In other places, he will use a kind of high style language that, for example, when Eowyn fights the Lord of the Nazgul, that makes a kind of veiled references to things like King Lear, to Shakespeare, to the biblical style in other places. I mean, his style, it varies so much, and it's very deliberate in each place. And the hobbits definitely talk like Anglo-Saxon peasants would have, I think.
Interesting. We had Simon Winchester on talking about his book about the Oxford English Dictionary, on which Tolkien worked for a couple of years, and the big movement that it was one time of people who thought English should be stripped of its Latinate and Gallic pretensions and gone back to Anglo-Saxon roots, and I guess Tolkien was one of those guys?
Well, he wasn't as much as some of the other guys who'd been Oxford a generation or so before, who were deliberately doing that, but he just knew so much more, and he had such a wider vocabulary and knew how to use it specifically. I mean, occasionally he would say something like, be it resolved, the Norman conquest was an unqualified disaster, or something like that.
Well, but you should also note that Tolkien had a dual discipline. He was a professor both of literature and of Anglo-Saxon. So he had philology, which was the the technical study of the language and also the literary or stylistic use of the language as well.
Michael Drought, we have to let you go. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Michael Drought edited a new version of Tolkien's Beowulf and the Critics. He's a professor of English at Wheaton College in Massachusetts, and he was with us from the studios of WBUR in Boston. And now let's welcome in another guest. As we discuss them, it becomes hard to separate Tolkien's academic and creative careers. His scholarship obviously runs through his fictional works. And joining us now to talk about Tolkien the academic is Tom Shippey. He's the author of J.R.R. Tolkien, Author of the Century, Chair of Humanities at St. Louis University in Missouri, and we reach him on winter holiday in Dorset, England. Thank you very much for joining us, Professor.
Hello, I'm glad to be able to talk to you.
You taught at Oxford in the past. I understand you overlapped a bit with Tolkien.
Yes, not much, of course. I followed his footsteps in many ways, starting from being at the same high school, you would say, in America. But I was 50 years younger than him, so we met only in the last year of his life when I started as a fellow at Oxford and he was living in retirement at Merton College.
What was he like?
Well, I think by the time I met him, he was got rather wary. He'd been interviewed a lot. People had talked to him a lot. He wanted to sort of sound you out a bit before he went on to anything to see if you were going to say the kind of thing he expected. And he had to be reassured a bit before he would open up.
Now, we've been discussing the almost obsessive philological interest that Tolkien had throughout his life and brought to his writing. Was that still evident when you knew him?
Yes, very evident, actually, and it came out in rather odd ways. When I talked to him, I thought, I won't talk about The Lord of the Rings because I know everybody else has, and since we had lived in very much the same place, he used to live in Rednall, and I used to live the other side of the park, so I just talked to him about, the local area, and talked about people that I knew who I think were very often grandchildren of people he'd known, and it was really just sort of rather hobbit-like gossip. I think he was quite pleased to hear this, and he wanted to know the names of people. And I remember at one point I mentioned somebody called Peter Neave, and Tolkien's ears sort of pricked up, and I now realize that's because his Aunt Jane was called Neave, his Aunt Jane who lived at Bag End and for whom he produced The Adventures of Tom Bombadil. I didn't know that at the time. But he asked me, he said, what do you think Neave means as a name? And I said, well, I suppose it's probably a nickname in Old Norse, and it would mean Hnevi, fist. And he said, yes, but it could be an Old English name, couldn't it? It could be the reflex of Old English Hnaf, the name of the hero. And I said, yes, I suppose so, but of course it would mean the same thing, wouldn't it? And Hnaf in Old English is called Haleth Halfdena, the hero of the Halfdane. So perhaps English and Norse, really weren't so far apart then. And he agreed with that. And then he went on to another name, which I could tell you about. But the point was really this, that Tolkien thought that these ancient hero names, dating back 1,500 years, hadn't gone away. They were still there. It was just people didn't recognize them anymore. And I heard Michael say something about Tolkien, being interested in the landscape. In a way, he thought that the names sort of grew into the landscape, that they were still there very often as place names. And because I knew the sort of area that he'd lived in, we could actually pick out a number of them and say, yes, well, that's right. That could well be the name of a hero, but now it's become just an ordinary... It's the kind of thing you see on a signpost, and people don't think about them anymore. But if they do think about them, then they realize, what a lot of sort of buried continuity there is.
We're talking about J.R.R. Tolkien, the author of The Lord of the Rings, with Daniel Grotta and Tom Shippey. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Ken, who joins us from Caminos, California.
Hey, how are you doing?
Okay.
I tell you, what a privilege just to be in the energy of this. One of the things I'm so impressed about, and I always have been since back in the hippie days, right, 60s and 70s, was just how Tolkien would take, he was like an alchemist with language, truly being able to create, gold out of lead is a good way of saying it. And how he would use the dark to really bring out the power and the goodness in all of us. Whether it be we're kings, having all the fortune and fame, and still stepping up to the plate, or a hobbit, a very unlikely creature.
Hmm.
And at that point, having the heart to bring the ring forth, rather than a great knight. And so, by bringing the darkness up, all of us and shine. And I really enjoyed that so much throughout the past three decades of my life.
Well, I we're going to be discussing this later, but this seems to be bearing on one of the points that that Tolkien talked about a lot, and that was that his fairy stories, a true fairy story, he thought was not for children but for adults, and there ought to be dark elements. Wouldn't you agree, Daniel Grotting?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, if you read the Brothers Grimm in the original, those stories were not for children. They were for adults.
Yeah.
And what about you, Tom Shippey?
Well, I'd like to pick up another point which the caller just made, which is, in a way, you could say Tolkien's commonness. Like many of the philologies, he was actually, in a way, terribly democratic. He didn't believe in correct English. He didn't believe in standard English. Just like the Grimm brothers, what he liked very much was to hear stories in dialect, or to hear it in, as it were, substandard or non-literary English. And he thought, actually, sort of separating literary English or literature from the rest of English or from, you know, mere popular fiction and so on, he thought that was entirely wrong. And actually, the kind of democratic spirit is there in the works, as well as the aristocratic spirit. You know, Aragorn is the returned king, but at the same time, he's perfectly capable of putting his feet up in the inn in Bree and talking to everybody on equal terms. And then you have characters like Sam Gamgee, who, in a way, is extremely common, but Tolkien didn't think that was a criticism in any way.
Ken, thanks very much.
One last thing real quick. What he really kept doing is allowing that undying spirit to keep coming forth, even in Gollum, with everybody. Anyway, thanks, guys.
Okay, Ken. Yeah. Thanks very much. Tom Shippey, can you stay with us? So we have to take a break.
Sure.
And also, of course, Daniel Grotta.
Of course.
All right. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll continue talking about J.R.R. Tolkien's life and literary legacy with Daniel Grotta and Tom Shippey. We'll be discussing his relationship with C.S. Lewis, the influence of Catholicism on his life and on his work. Also joining us will be fantasy author Ursula Le Guin, who will discuss J.R.R. Tolkien's legacy in terms of the field of fantasy fiction, which he did so much to popularize and, in a way, to create. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington, and here are a couple of the stories we're following today here at NPR News. Two federal court rulings today against the Bush administration's treatment of terror suspects. One said the government cannot call U.S. citizen Jose Padilla an enemy combatant. The other says hundreds of detainees at Guantanamo Bay should have access to U.S. courts and to lawyers. Also today, Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon said Israel will take unilateral steps to separate from Palestinians if a U.S.-backed peace plan fails. You can hear details on those stories coming up later today on All Things Considered from NPR News. Tomorrow on Talk of the Nation, join Ira Flatow on Science Friday for a look at the latest news on diagnosing and treating depression. That's tomorrow on Talk of the Nation. Today we're talking about the Lord of the Rings trilogy and its lasting impact on the fantasy genre. If you've braved the lines to see The Return of the King, give us a call. And our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. With us are Daniel Grotta, the author of J.R.R. Tolkien, Architect of Middle-Earth, a biography, and Tom Shippey, the author of J.R.R. Tolkien, the Author of the Century. And let's get another caller on the line, and this is Richard, who's with us from Waco, Texas.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the
please
air, Richard.
Please tell me about the relationship between Tolkien and C.S. Lewis, how they stimulated each other's ideas, and also how they spent time together. Thank you.
This was in a group, if I'm not mistaken, called the Inklings, correct?
That's right, yeah.
Yes.
Do you want me to take that question?
Well, why don't you start?
Okay. Well, obviously, I'd say straight off that Tolkien would never have finished if it hadn't been for Lewis's encouragement. Tolkien was 62 by the time The Lord of the Rings started to come out, and I think during the intervening years when he was writing it, he must have thought many times, you know, well, even if I finish this, you know, is anyone going to publish it? It'd be very easy to get discouraged and dry up. And I think that actually Lewis kept him going. by getting him to read chunks of it to the other Inklings and telling him how good it was and taking an interest and generally urging him on. And, of course, way back in about 1936, they had made an agreement that each of them would write a story. They tossed up for who would take which theme. And Lewis, of course, being a fast finisher, you know, had his work all done. The first one came out 2 years later. He had it all finished by 1945. And Tolkien was still, you know, working away on the same thing. But I think that Lewis was both a stimulation and, in a way, a kind of, I would almost say, a role model to Tolkien, though Tolkien was famously uninfluenceable. But at least he could see Lewis, you know, getting on and being successful, and I think that probably gave him another additional stimulus.
Daniel Grotta, C.S. Lewis, of course, another Catholic intellectual.
Well, actually, C.S. Lewis wasn't Catholic. He was Church of England. But he was part of a group of literary compatriots, common spirits called the Inklings, Owen Barfield, Charles William, Gervase Matthew. There were about six or seven that were regular, and then they came and went. In fact, Tolkien's son, Christopher, was invited to be part of the Inklings when he returned from service in South Africa with the Royal Air Force. The Inklings met generally once a week in the back room of a pub, or several pubs, actually. Tolkien was more or less in the company of men. Even though he had a daughter, his wife was not really sociable. In fact, she was a very shy person and probably what we would call manic depressive today. So he was thrown into the company of men rather early on. And he enjoyed being with them. He could smoke his pipe. He could eat the foods he loved, which incidentally were the same foods that hobbits loved, such as mushrooms out of a field. And it was this influence, this reinforcement that he got, especially from Lewis, that gave him impetus to continue writing week after week, even though they would groan sometimes at his puns and some of the writings, and they would say, you can do better. He would simply go on his own way rather than revise.
Tom Shippey, an email for you before we let you go. This is from Tom Eaton in Kansas City. Interesting to note, he writes, there is virtually no religion in The Lord of the Rings, no mention of gods, no rituals, etc. The closest to it is when Frodo and Sam are detained by Faramir and his men, and before the evening meal, Faramir says, we face to the west to Numenor that was, and Elven home that is, and that which is beyond Elven home and shall ever be. For all his own faith, Tolkien apparently consciously avoided loading down the story with overtly religious baggage.
Yes, and I think actually, in a way, that was also, in a sense, an Inkling theme that I think Lewis and Tolkien probably talked about it. And I think what interested them both was the question of what you should feel about, shall we say, early North Europeans who had never had Christianity preached to them, who remained, you know, resolutely pagan because they'd never had any other option. What were you to think about them? Some people would say, well, there is no salvation outside the church, so they're all going to go to hell. They've got no alternative. Others would think, well, that doesn't seem fair, in that they've never, in a sense, had the option. And so you have the notion, the Catholic notion, of limbo, that there's a kind of medial place between heaven and hell for the uncommitted. Well, I don't think Tolkien particularly liked that idea either, but he did present Middle Earth as a sort of as a sort of limbo, and also as a sort of blank space in which the characters are trying to do the best they can, which can on some occasions be very good, without the assistance of divine revelation. But that, I think, is why, and I go back to something I heard Michael Drout say a bit back, that is why they're always fighting the long defeat, because the best that human beings can do is never good enough. They have to have assistance in the end from outside. And the people in Middle-earth, of course, like Faramir, the wisest of them, are hoping that this help will come from the outside, but they have no idea what form it will take. I'll tell you one other bit of religion in The Lord of the Rings. When Tom Bombadil dismisses the Barrow-wight, he says, go wait where gates are ever shut till the world is mended. And that means that the world is going to be mended, but not even Tom Bombadil knows how it's going to happen.
Well, Tom Shippey, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Tom Shippey, Chair of Humanities at St. Louis University in Missouri. We reached him today on his holiday in Dorset, England. His latest book is J.R.R. Tolkien, Author of the century. And let's talk now a bit about the legacy of J.R.R. Tolkien. And joining us now is Ursula Le Guin. And when she was already at work on her Earthsea trilogy when The Lord of the Rings hit the shelves in the U.S. And she joins us now from her home in Portland, Oregon. And Ursula Le Guin, it's a pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you.
Tell us how you came to read The Lord of the Rings the first time.
Well, I'd read reviews about it, and they sounded fascinating. But I was a little bit leery or wary because they sounded so wonderful that I was afraid it wouldn't be as good as the reviews made it sound. So I put it off for quite a while, and then when I finally got to it, I read the first volume in one night and was waiting at the library doors the next morning when the library opened to make sure that somebody wouldn't get away with the second volume. I think I read it in 3 days.
You couldn't have gotten an awful lot of sleep.
I'm not sure it's really possible to have read it in 3 days, but that's what I remember. And then I lived in Middle Earth for about a month after that.
Did it change how you looked at what you wrote or could write?
It kind of opened a big door for a lot of us who were writing over on the science fiction, fantasy, whatever you call it, the imaginative edge of fiction. Tolkien he gave us a kind of enormous permission. He said, yes, you can write for grown-ups. Yes, you can deal with moral seriousness, with big moral problems. It was nothing specific so much as, for me, so much as just this huge validation or permission of the whole enterprise of fantastic writing as opposed to realistic writing.
Was there much of a fantasy genre before him?
It wasn't really a genre. There were fantasies. There were some great fantasies. And there were wonderful fantasy stories by people like Kipling. But it was not... of course, the genre is a commercial thing.
Mm-hmm.
And in a sense, I think you would have to say that Tolkien unintentionally invented the genre, commercial genre.
We're speaking with Ursula Le Guin and Daniel Grotta about J.R.R. Tolkien and The Lord of the Rings. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We have an email from Jay Gibson King in Tallahassee, Florida. One of the major themes, if you want to call it that, of The Lord of the Rings is the absence of women. They are conspicuously absent. The story of the Entwives comes to mind. Is the early death of Tolkien's mother an inspiration for this, or are there other reasons? Daniel Grotta, what do you think?
Well, the only reason he wrote women in there was because his daughter Priscilla asked for some romance and some characters. But The Lord of the Rings is free from the influence of women because Tolkien's life, by and large, was free from the influence of women. And the stories he wrote, other than The Lord of the Rings, very rarely dealt with women. I think that was sort of an unknown country to him.
Did you get that impression when you read them, Ursula Le Guin?
Well, I would say Tolkien wasn't free of the influence of women. Any man who had a wife who looked after him is not all that free of the influence of women. But he was writing in a extremely male tradition. There aren't a lot of women in Beowulf or in the Norse stories that he was working from. And fantasy as a whole at that point was very macho. He didn't have women, but he sort of demachified it in taking the emphasis off the big hero and putting it on the common man, common person.
Or common hobbit, in his case.
Or common hobbit, yes. And hobbits, you know, are kind of like kids. They're little. They're not strong people. They're not big, strong heroes. Joseph Campbell didn't know what to do with hobbits.
Let's get another caller in. Raul is with us from New York.
Yes, how you doing?
Okay.
Basically, one thing I'm curious about is, were all the creatures in The Lord of the Rings inventions of Tolkien, or were they all borrowed from European myths? I guess I'm thinking of the Treants specifically, whether Well, that's my question.
Okay. Daniel Grotter, what do you think?
Well, the Ents and the Hobbits were particularly Tolkien. In fact, the Hobbit came about when he was marking term papers, which he did for extra money, and he came to a blank spot on a page, and for some reason he just wrote, "In the hole in the ground lived a hobbit." And he said, "Aha, I wonder what a hobbit is." And he started to write the story. It was originally told to his children as a bedtime story. The Ents also were wholly original, moving, intelligent, sentient trees. But the rest, you could make a good case saying that they were all borrowed from mythology one way or the other.
Thanks for the call, Raoul.
Thank you.
Ursula Le Guin, I know you've written about Tolkien's structural skill as a writer, and in that, given that, I wanted to read this email we got from Mark Fearnow at Hanover College. All this talk of style in Tolkien, he writes, is sadly misguided. Let's face it, the books are boring, padded out, predictable, and in terms of language, bland.
Poor fellow. I'm so sorry for you. Yeah, well, you know, there's people who don't like Yeats, and there's people who don't like Dickens, and you can't argue with either taste or incapacity.
What would you say? You know, he's cast a long shadow. If you are reading in the genre of fantasy today, is there a lot that isn't influenced by Tolkien?
Well. Yeah, we all stand on the shoulders of giants. Yes, there is a lot of fantasy that is not directly influenced by Tolkien. Again, I would have to say that the existence of a large market for fantasy, the awareness of fantasy as a legitimate mode of fiction, Tolkien had a lot to do with that. But they're all kinds of different. I mean, you know, there's dark urban fantasies. And
yeah, that's true.
And it's not all. Could I just put in a word here and say it is not all a battle between good and evil? That is a terrific misrepresentation of what fantasy does.
Ursula Le Guin joined us from her home in Portland, Oregon, and she is one of the leading writers of fantasy. You may remember the Earthsea series, as well as numerous other novels, short stories, and essays, famously The Lathe of Heaven. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Daniel Grotter, we appreciate your time as well.
Well, thank you for having me.
Daniel Grotter is the author of J.R.R. Tolkien, Architect of Middle-Earth, and he was with us from the studios of member station WHYY in Philadelphia. We promised you a stories about the toys of Iraqi freedom. We'll do that on Monday. Ira will be here tomorrow, and we'll be back with you on Monday afternoon if you're on the East or the Middle West, and Monday morning if you're on the West Coast. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.